So I'm here with Dave. He is the head of Immunity, the CEO, and we're going to talk about today about sort of policy and strategy. So of, you know, how states, corporations, individuals approach cyberspace, InfoSec, whatever you want to call it. In our Loopcast sort of InfoSec series, we have tried to, you know, get as much opinion as possible, you know, from people like Jason Healy, you know, from people who are, you know, actively working in the industry. And so I want you to, the audience, to sort of consider this conversation to be a natural extension to sort of, you know, look at and think about InfoSec and sort of how it affects politics and how politics sort of, you know, international politics affects InfoSec. So let me start off with, you know, how do we describe the internet as a sort of strategic space? You know, I think, you know, not just a sort of space where you get your news, sports, you know, YouTubes of cats playing the piano, but, you know, how do we, you know, what are the tenets of thinking about, you know, the internet, cyberspace, information security as a strategic space?
I always point back when I think about how policymakers are looking at it as a strategic space at what I thought was a great talk from Michael Hayden at Black Hat, which you can download for free, I believe, on the interwebs. And part of what he did was really try to differentiate it from an attacker's perspective. So, you know, he looks at it the way a tank driver would look at it. I guess he looks at everything the way a tank driver would look at it, because that is his background. But, you know, in that sense, he's translating the space that is cyber into what he thinks of as terrain, and he's trying to make analogies in his own head, you know, and how you attack that and defend that. So from the strategic standpoint of how is this space, you know, effective for a military or government, I think it's also, you know, how does it shape our society? How can we use it to manipulate things both sort of long term and immediately? And, you know, I listened to the Jason Healy Loopcast, and, you know, there is that sort of side of things of, you know, we don't think of this as kinetic. I think he's very down on the idea that the cyberspace world plays into our kinetic world, and so people think of it as a very different space. But, you know, I think modern strategists in the field would disagree and would say that it is immediately kinetic, that it is attached in many places to every part of what we do, and that in some ways that is what makes it different. And, you know, you started this off with how do we even define these terms? And, you know, I used to be one of those people who was very snippety at the term cyberspace, but frankly, I got over it. And I think, you know, most people should get over it now. It comes, you know, the term cyberspace comes from Gibson, I believe, and therefore has, you know, at least some level of justifiability there, but is also probably the only way to really describe what we're talking about. It's not even just computers. At some level, it is the space of what you perceive and how people think and how all of our little beings are connected together. It really is a different thing. So, you know, I think we're still struggling at how we deal with it strategically. I don't think there's any one answer. I think my answers are better than everyone else's answers, but that doesn't mean that they are.
I mean, so what are the sort of the pieces of this space? I mean, are we just talking about, you know, you, me, computer, server, you know, fiber optics, or, you know, or is it much more complex than that? I mean, is it, you know, are we sort of integrating, you know, the mobile sort of section of this, and then, you know, I guess with the internet of everything, eventually the coffee maker. But, I mean,
right. I mean, you had, yeah, I also listened to your car hacking talk that you had. So, internet of everything, you know, I actually hate that term because it's not, it's like, it tries to reach very far, you know, the theory of everything, physics kind of stuff. But nonetheless, your car has been a computer for a long time. And just because it all of a sudden got hooked up into the steering doesn't necessarily mean that it wasn't always hooked up into the brakes. And you know, recently, of course, you get Bluetooth, and if you look at a Tesla, the whole thing is a computer. So what does it consist of? What strategically does this space consist of? I think it's changing over time as our society changes the way it uses computers and information technology. But deep down, it's sort of anything information technology is really the easiest way to describe it.
So, you know, let's go to sort of who are the actors? You would consider the actors in this space. I mean, I think in my notes and sort of our pre-interview, you know, I sort of broke it down as states, corporations, and then sort of individuals and non-state actors. But, I mean, you know, what are the sort of the entities in this space that are sort of being layered on to everything IT?
Well, you know, I have a talk I gave at RSA in 2012 where I tried to define the term cyber weapon a little bit more clearly than what I thought it was being defined as, because I'm pretty clear that the Pirate Bay is a cyber weapon. And I think you would determine them as a non-state actor in some level. And so I don't know which one of us is right. But deep down, I think a lot of these things are really blurry. I think people have looked recently, especially at Google, at the NSA, and decided that they're kind of one and the same thing. Or they've looked at you know, Huawei and the Chinese government and decided that they're, in fact, the same thing. It's at the most important strategic level. So, you know, the non-state actors, I think, are a much more interesting part of the new landscape in terms of, you know, obviously WikiLeaks and Edward Snowden and all this other sort of noise that's happening right now, I think is a very clear sort of force vector that we haven't seen quite often. But, you know, there's a really great blog post on Snowden, which describes a little bit much more about these actors. It's by a Cornell professor, and it's called HackingDistributed.com. And he says how the Snowden saga will end. He has a very difficult to pronounce name, and I'm going to screw it up here, but his name is Emin Gunsiga, or something like that. But he has a very good point about sort of how do you make a metric for the force vectors that are going to define our policy. And he sort of describes it as military, political, commerce, and then the public. And he sort of has a very clear description of what all these things mean and how they're sort of moving the big ball that is our information security policy in different directions and when and why and how you can sort of determine it almost as a scientific theory. I thought it was a great post, and he has a great way of thinking about this stuff. And basically what he says is that, you know, when people aren't paying attention, generally the military gets its way, the sort of military political force vector gets its way, which also includes, obviously, your intelligence. But, you know, if you look at the commerce force vector, which would be sort of all the companies that are involved in global commerce, they have a very clear disincentive to play ball with a lot of these sort of intelligence aims. I mean, it's ridiculously clear. And the public as well has its own priorities. And so I don't know that necessarily you can define things as non-state actors, you know, corporations, military, government, and all that muck. Because the reality is all governments across the globe wish all corporations to stop using strong crypto. And up to date, they've been very successful. And we may be seeing a turn in that fact, in that the public and the companies may decide that, in fact, strong cryptography is going to be something they use, and they're not going to take no for an answer. And that will drastically change the environment in cyberspace. And I think that's one of the reasons we're living in such interesting times.
Interesting. So, I mean, what do you see, you know, as key responsibilities then? I mean, if you were to sort of say the United States versus Google versus WikiLeaks, I mean, you know, not responsibilities, but sort of objectives and intentions, because it seems like, you know, if the state doesn't want Google to use, or a corporate or any company to use strong crypto, but yet it is sort of dependent on Google to get to get a certain amount of information. I mean, it seems like there's a tension there, and at the same time, you know, there's, if you're a non-state group or a weapon or whatever, I mean, it seems like, you know, you can build your own objectives and your own interests away from both, you know, company and the state. So, I mean, what do you see as, I mean, what are the, how do you sort of aggregate interests and sort of intentions in this system?
I think the interests and intentions of the people who run WikiLeaks, you know, I think they're one interesting example, but I think a better example, honestly, is the Pirate Bay, which you don't see being discussed in national security angles, but which is, in some ways, a much more sterling example of a particular kind of cyber weapon that I call an offering cyber weapon. And both of those two things, their sole goal is to offer people information, and they use that offensively. And I find that that's such a complex strategic thought that it really does escape high-level political analysts and sort of national security analysts, because they don't usually see that as an offensive action. But in cyberspace, this is one of the more powerful offensive actions you can have. And only until WikiLeaks happened did anyone start paying attention. And realistically, now that Snowden's happened, you have, you know, much more attention placed on it. But they should have been paying attention with the Pirate Bay, which happened years earlier, and is the exact same thing, but more so. And, you know, it is not, I think it is not wrong to say that the public has an interest in diminishing copyright and intellectual property protection as a whole. And the Pirate Bay is the public's way of pushing that forward, because, you know, as much as the commercial sort of sector of the world would love to have everyone under very strict digital rights management, it didn't matter at all if everyone got all of their material off the Pirate Bay, which is what happened. And the same thing's realistically true about WikiLeaks and how they change the way news can be controlled. If the public can have access to the raw sources, then you can't control your news the way the nation states want to control their news. And so all of these things really feed into all sorts of different areas, but for sure you're seeing the tension between the military and political arms and the commercial arms right now very clearly, because they're all screaming and yelling about how they're getting caught out, particularly with PRISM and whatnot. But the real story here is much, much more painful if they actually looked at cryptography controls, if they looked at import and export rules for software, for example, which, you know, my company Fields is a software company. You know, all of these things, the commercial sector in general is extremely unhappy with and is pushing back on the very idea of a nation state. Because the idea of a nation state, deep down, is something that can protect you. And frankly, they're not doing a great job at it.
Interesting. So, I mean, let's talk about leaks then. I mean, it seems, you know, is the power of a leak in sort of, you know, being able to say that your information isn't secure, or is it in the value of taking private information and making it public? Because, I mean, to sort of build on your point, I mean, it seems like there's a difference between Manning and Snowden. I mean, the information that Manning sort of leaked was, I mean, if I understand it correctly, most of it is just, was basically, you know, standard fare, you know, what the State Department was doing that particular day, how it interacted with people. But then you compare it to the Snowden leaks, and it seems, you know, the Snowden leaks seem much more serious. So, I mean, with that, I mean, is the power of a leak sort of basically saying to an adversary, the way you protect information is insecure, and sort of, you know, mocking it? Or is it more, or is it really the value of the information that was put out into public?
You have a very interesting point there, which I think is quite subtle, right? Like, and I think this is one of the things about, Julian Assange, and just hackers in general in the national security sector is that I think for a long time people underestimated their capability of strategic thought. And, you know, recently even Michael Hayden came out and he started making fun of hackers and saying that they, you know, just, you know, 22-year-old kids who don't get laid and sit in their mother's basements, which you can say all well and good until they're beating you. And Julian Assange has been beating them, you know, in a large way for a long time at this point. So I think there are clear differences, but there are two messages here, as you say. There's the message that no information will be secure because there's always someone willing to leak it, and therefore the entire way you do business has to change. And that's a very similar message to the message of free software and the sort of GPL movement. And it's sort of, they're all tied together in some complex way I'm not sure about. And then there's also the specific damage from any particular leak or set of, you know, documents that have gone out. You know, would British Petroleum be able to do business the way they think they can do business if they knew that their internal documents on damage control were going to get leaked to WikiLeaks or to a similar organization? I don't think they would be able to. And that is a really strong way of changing society. That is really the definition of a cyber weapon, is that it can change things in a big way.
Interesting.
And the Pirate Bay is the same, of course, but, you know, less controversial.
I mean, in that sense, then, I mean, isn't the state's ultimate power then sort of the power of law and sort of, and by law, you know, the ability to sort of, you know, not just protect, but also sort of, coerce and sort of, you know, to say that, you know, there's only so much we can tolerate. I mean, sort of going back to Snowden, I mean, it seems like, yeah, Snowden leaked and was able to sort of, you know, bring a lot of stuff to light, but at the same time, you know, he was sort of stuck in, you know, the Russian airport. I really can't pronounce it, but I mean, and he couldn't really escape because the United States was able to sort of poke and prod and say, look, you know, you can't do that. You can't sort of give him asylum. So I'm sort of curious. I mean, doesn't the state's power of, you know, diplomacy, law, and maybe even violence sort of come into play then? Where does it come into play? How about that?
No, but I think yes, you're totally right that, and I'm not going to argue for Snowden having done the right thing, since I don't necessarily think he did the right thing. You know, all my friends want him shot with a very high caliber weapon. But the reality is that, you know, the Snowden example is just one of many examples. The other clear example is the Chinese hacking into every company in America. So, and or realistically the world, that has anything to do with commerce and taking all the IP out. You know, that's the exact kind of attack that companies are expecting their government to protect themselves from. And I don't just mean the U.S. government. I mean, all governments have been tasked, whether they want it or not, with protecting their companies from sophisticated cyber intrusions that will affect their company's bottom line, because the companies can't do it themselves. So when the companies cannot protect themselves and the government does not protect them or cannot protect them is when you see the very concept of nation state taking a hit, and in some cases a fatal hit.
So I want to sort of move away from the idea of leaks and into, you know, what else attacks? I mean, it seems like our conversation is centered around the idea that, you know, at a strategic level, it's not just the tools that matter, but sort of the movement of data, sort of, you know, I would consider a leak a sort of a movement of data from secure to unsecure and sort of that sort of thing. But where do you put sort of insertion and deletion, wholesale deletion, and, you know, maybe even outright manipulation of data? I mean, I think it was the Cyscan talk, the one you did in 2013. I was sort of caught by it, by saying, I'm paraphrasing, but it had to do with Shamoon, sort of the attacks on Saudi Aramco and how data was wholesale deleted. So we don't know if it was, you know, the public details, or we don't know if it's been moved, but all we know is that, you know, everything was sort of wiped. So, I mean, is sort of deletion, you know, a a strategic move for either a nation state or a group of individuals.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that one, because on Jason Healy's Loopcast, he said he used that same example as an example of an attack that did not work. And, you know, one thing I like that's great about using cyber as a weapon is that there's so many gradients of it, that you as the Iranians can demonstrate the ability to stop Saudi petroleum production without actually having to do it, which is very difficult to do in the physical space. And I think that's exactly what they did. I don't think it failed at all. I think it did exactly what they wanted them to do. I think they were firing a warning shot at the Saudi Arabians and also at the United States and saying, you know, if you guys proceed further with the kinds of attacks you're doing, we're going to take the Saudi national oil companies offline. And you might think that they can continue to do production that way, but frankly, we don't. And I think they're completely right, to be honest. The Iranians have invested very strongly in their cyber team, and they know exactly what they're doing. So, you know, this is deletion and deletion of particular data, in particular the oil industry or any of these areas. You know, a lot of these things don't come back up. When you turn off a SCADA machine, sometimes it does not turn back on. In fact, you know, usually these machines are very difficult to get back online and functioning. And, you know, Immunity's done some reviews for some very large facilities where, you know, they're like, you know, we'd love to patch that machine, but if that machine reboots, then this giant arm of our factory goes away and it doesn't come back. We have to rebuild it. You know, those can be extremely dangerous attacks. And, you know, so again, I'm going to have to, you know, point out that I think in modern strategic thinking, cyber has concrete, immediate, gradiated physical results, and therefore is an extremely valuable part of your military arm.
I mean, can you think of anything? I mean, if deletion is a sort of an attack here, I mean, can we think of the sort of the flip side of that, insertion, as a sort of, I mean, you know, in doing research for
Look at what happened to the Dow when the Syrian Electronic Army inserted something into a Twitter feed. Mm. It went down like 120 points, right?
Right.
I mean, and they recently demonstrated that they can also do that to the Wall Street Journal, or not the Wall Street Journal. They did the Washington Post, and they did, I can't remember what other paper they did. There's another big paper they did. Was it the New York Times? It might have been the Times. But regardless, I mean, being able to manipulate news and say things that can make a huge difference, you know, I mean, on one hand, it's basic PSYOP strategy, but on the other hand, they could do that to stock figures, and they can do it to all sorts of different things that are probably even more damaging. You know, if you can change telemetry on a lot of different devices, then really bad things do start happening.
So, I mean, how would you set up a defense to all this? Like, what is a defense, if you can even call it that? It seems like, you know, with the postmortem of the Syrian Electronic Army attacks, it was just basically phishing and social engineering. It was, you know, somebody said,
Yeah, right.
So go ahead.
Yeah, you're totally right. I mean, that's what it was, and they're good at it. And you know, I don't think a newspaper should be expected to defend itself from a nation state. I mean, that's a very David and Goliath kind of, you know, power distribution. It's just not possible. And the same thing's true for most companies in America. They can't expect to defend themselves from the Syrian Electronic Army. So, you know, those are real world events that I think are very clear in how they delimitate where the responsibilities are.
So, I mean, then how do you set up a defense? I mean, is a company responsible for its own defense, or do you have to bring in, you know, parts of the state? I mean, how do you arrange sort of a defense to sort of attacks that are almost nebulous and almost sort of, you know, you can't readily identify a source, or you can't identify the source until after the attack?
Well, I think, you know, General Alexander or Dern says he's known, has been trying to push this idea of a completely monitored internet, that the NSA spends their time monitoring and protecting you for you. And it has the advantage of maybe even working to some level. So you'd hook into sort of the NSA net, or as you would call it, the internet, Verizon Business or whatever it is. It's the one DSL line that you have. And when the Chinese tried to send you malware, phishing attacks, they'd just magically disappear and get cleared from the system, and the NSA would take care of all this for you the way any good managed security service would, but with the advantage of, you know, magic. And it has, let's say a 10% chance of actually working. But the downside is, at this point, there's no reputational trust there, and there isn't a solid level of defense that they can run. And, you know, I actually agreed with Jason Healy when he talked about how there's no real reason the offensive team should be running so rampant through cyberspace the way they are compared to the defensive teams. You know, I think this is a pendulum that sort of swings back and forth, and we've seen it sort of pegged to offense for a long time now, that we think that's just the way it's going to be. But it's not realistically the way it's going to be forever. You know, software is getting more secure over time. Especially the basics, Microsoft, for example, is one of the core pieces of the internet, and they're just much more secure than they used to be. It's just difficult. So there's a number of sort of cyber defenses. And I would say that the first one I would assign to people to start with is situational awareness. And then the second one might have to be incident response. And I think that if you look at these strategically, we do not have either of these things at a national level or at a realistically corporate level today.
So, I mean, how would you, you know, if tomorrow, let's say hypothetical, somebody came to you and said, you know what, could you, you know, Dave from Immunity, sort of write the incident response plan and sort of the situational awareness PowerPoint. I don't know how these things go, but I'm assuming it's in PowerPoint. But, you know, how would you sort of explain this to a policymaker or even the head of a corporation?
Well, the head of a corporation is the easiest, right? So I say, do you know all the binaries that have run on your systems today? And then they say, no, I would have no way of knowing how I'd even get that data. And you say, well, let's start there. Because until you know that, you don't even have the beginnings of situational awareness. And part of the problem is that most companies have tried to do situational awareness by looking at their network traffic. And network traffic is a particularly bad place to do situational awareness. It is a giant stream of chaotic, ever-changing data that has extremely high entropy and extremely low signal. And, you know, you're trying to filter it. Filtering's hugely expensive. It's essentially the worst-case scenario for a defender. That said, operating systems, especially like your modern ones, have gotten signed, sealed. They're much less chaotic. Your average person only executes like 3 things a day. They probably leave Word running. They probably leave Outlook running. They maybe run the calculator every so often. They really don't do a whole lot. So situational awareness is something you can gain. You have to do it on the endpoints. It's not cheap, but it's doable. They have to invest in analysis, like people who actually look at stuff and understand things. That's not cheap either, and it's not a team they have on board usually. And when they do all these things correctly, they do succeed. And you start seeing just the ability to understand what's happening in your information infrastructure is success when it comes down to how do you build this. And when I was a kid at the fort, I had this hacker mentor, and I was learning basic hacking 101. And he said, you know, whoever wins is the person who knows the most about the network, and it's very simple. And right now, that's the offensive teams for whatever reason, even though the defenders have all the advantages. The offensive teams have taken the effort to learn more about their target networks than the targets have. And it's not hard for the targets to change that equation. And that definitely is the first step. I think the second step, probably the incident response step, is is sometimes more political than technological. You have to sort of look at why things are happening and be able to get rid of technologies. You have to just say no to certain things. For example, here at Immunity, we had a forum. It got hacked by the Iranians, and then we refused to use anything PHP-based forever because everything PHP-based is completely insecure. There's just no way around it. And sometimes those are the kind of decisions you have to be able to make. And the same thing's true on a military and political level, at the nation state level. You know, there's certain ways you can do business and certain ways you cannot do business. And we've started to make some of the harder decisions. We're saying, no, we're not going to be buying Huawei parts for our internal networks, and neither will our partners. And if our partners do this, we will not partner with them. So when you go to the Australians and you say, listen, you guys can feel free to build your national network out of Huawei equipment, but we will no longer be including you in Five Eyes, then things change very quickly.
So I think sort of what's been left out of this conversation is, you know, how does an individual sort of navigate all this? And, you know, I'm not just talking about sort of an individual with technical skill, but sort of an individual, you know, a citizen, so to speak, you know, somebody who is accessing the internet and using it for business and for, you know, surfing or whatever. I mean, you know, where do we put the population in all this? I mean, is this, you know, is the responsibility of the state to ensure the protection of individuals, but then where do we put corporations, you know, in the sense of information? Because it seems like, you know, to use a sort of analogy, you know, I have a lot more information on Google than I would have on a state database or a federal database. So, I mean, you know, where do corporations and states come in when it comes to the average Joe?
Well, I think we're kind of going through a very strange time in America right now, where people are trying to readdress this, for sure. It may come down to the fact that there's enough pressure from the public that Outlook and other places start including encryption in email and in voice and other things as a natural element, as opposed to being diametrically opposed to it wherever possible. You know, managing your identity and the policies that they have. I mean, Facebook's policy where you have to be a real person, for example. You know, that's something people are right now putting up with, and I don't know if that's going to continue. I think if there was a Facebook where you didn't have to use your real name, that's what people would do. And I don't think necessarily everybody on Earth is going to care about cyber technology issues and cybersecurity. But I think enough of them will that the features will end up being default. And that's when things really do start changing. You know, part of it's just because if you look at the feature right now, there are things that are the American public certainly does not agree with, but I think the world's public doesn't agree with. And I'll use the example of the NSA database going to the Drug Enforcement Agency. You know, if most people smoke pot in America, like probably about 80% of people in America smoke pot. And if the Drug Enforcement Agency decided to fine each and every one of them $100 for doing it, then I think we're going to start seeing the government change very quickly. And the reason the laws have stayed the way they are is because, you know, the enforcement has been so lax. But once people start seeing how the government actually does threaten them with this stuff, they start getting pretty rigorous about this. And that's sort of, I think that was probably the most damaging leak to come out of this from the government's perspective, was the connection to the Drug Enforcement Agency. You know, if the FBI decided that they in fact are going to be fining everybody who downloads movies and songs and whatnot from the internet, then things drastically change very quickly because the populace will not put up with it. And that's what people are looking at when they see this, all these NSA leaks. And they're not thinking about, oh, our national security issues, whatever. They're thinking, man, does the government know that time when I called my drug dealer? Because I don't want them to know that. Now what do I do? And it becomes very personal very quickly.
Right. I mean, would that sort of, I think there was a statistic out there that said, you know, after, you know, about, you know, through these, you know, NSA disclosures or leaks or whatever you want to call them, you know, the use of PGP has gone up, you know, I don't know what the percentage was, but it was an insane amount that 300% would, you know, had gone up since the beginning of the, you know, the NSA leaks. So, I mean, you know, for an individual, for an average individual, is sort of PGP and sort of, you know, these sort of off-the-shelf encryption, you know, is that enough? Or is it really just a matter of sort of, you know, just practicing good OPSEC and sort of, you know, not talking on the phone about buying drugs?
But not talking about buying drugs on the phone is not the problem, because no one does that. They just call their dealer and say, hey, I want to meet up. Right? Like, the fact that you called a dealer is enough for the DEA to come knocking at your door. And, you know, I mean, that, the same thing's true about, you know, maybe I visited Pirates Bay. Maybe I didn't. But if you visit Pirates Bay, pretty much you only had one reason to do that. And there's no reason for the FBI not to check out what's on your computer and do a little analysis. So, you know, I think the whole metadata thing's really retarded, because everyone keeps going on and on about it, but the American public thinks of it as the most dangerous thing in the whole world. You can tell the American public every day that you're not listening to their phone calls, and if they're like, but you know who I called, that's just as scary. Nobody is confused about this except in our policy circles right now, or our PR circles, because their PR team right now is sucking it. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, PGP is the technology that will succeed. I think it's something that will get integrated by Microsoft and by Google and by Apple, and it will be better than PGP, and it will be 100 times more dangerous, and we've always known this was coming, which is why we've always known SIGINT is completely dead. There's two things that kill SIGINT. One of them is complexity, because the complexity of the world's networks, it rises exponentially, which is faster than you can build computers. And the other one's encryption. And encryption comes down on you like a blanket and suffocates your SIGINT, and you're left with, you know, metadata. And both of these things mean the only thing that's going to work in the future, if you want any kind of signals intelligence, is targeted access. And targeted access is hard. That's a strategic definition for you right there.
So, you know, I want to sort of, you know, get into the end of the show with two sort of controversial issues, you know, besides the NSA and all this stuff. One is the zero-day market, and the other one is hacking back, or the idea of active defense and sort of, you know, going out and, you know, actually hunting down folks. I mean, not hunting physically, but digitally. Let's start with the zero-day market. I mean, you know, I think there's sort of two sets of arguments that I've heard thus far on the show, and, you know, and I think one of them is that the government should be out of the zero-day market, and it should be sort of a true free market that, you know, for companies and black hats and white hats to sort of figure out and sort of, you know, work around. And then the other argument is that the government should be involved and sort of, you know, should be buying up zero days, you know, for whatever end interest that is. I mean, where do you stand on this sort of argument and sort of, you know, problem?
I don't see it as a problem. You know, I know there's people out there who want to do what they call regulate cyber weapons, but I don't think of vulnerabilities as a cyber weapon, first of all. And second of all, I don't really believe regulation is the answer to all our problems. But, you know, the government has no choice because, you know, as I've mentioned, targeted access is the only way forward. And that means all governments are going to be heavily investing in weaknesses, trojans, cryptographic issues and flaws and protocols, basically in situational awareness and understanding of how things work on the internet, because whoever understands it best is going to control the whole thing. And there's no way people are ever going to turn their back on that, because this is the new commons. It's how you control everything. It's going to be bigger than the Navy. And as much money as we spend on buying useless aircraft carriers now, we're going to spend on useful cyber attacks in the future.
Interesting. So I think sort of, just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry. So going to the next sort of controversial issue, hacking back. I mean, how does a company approach, if it should even approach this sort of idea of hacking back? I mean, is it okay for a company to sort of hack back? Is it not okay? What are your sort of thoughts on this?
Well, I think, the obvious, there's two sides of this. One is that you're hacking on behest of a government, and that's what we claim, and in fact, I pretty much believe Huawei does. And we get very, very upset when they do that. And the other one is a corporation hacking as a way of discovering enough about its attackers to defend itself properly. And defense in this case could mean legal, or could mean physical, or could mean, otherwise, simply understanding how they got in so you can close it off. The only reason corporations are willing to even consider the concept of hacking back, which is clearly illegal in every jurisdiction that you can find, is that the governments are not providing them with what they would consider the requisite service of protecting them enough. And deep down, I don't think there's any controversy over hacking back, because it's obviously not something corporations are even capable of doing. I mean, unless you're an information security corporation, or maybe as big as Google, you don't have the technical team that's going to be hacking back. It's not going to happen. You have to hire a third party for this. And realistically, that's not going to happen either. I mean, there's no market for this. It's not something that I would see in the near or far future. It's been an awesome marketing play by incident response people to say that they're doing offensive security, when what they're doing is setting up honeypots, which I think is a useful behavior, but certainly not offensive in nature. So, maybe I don't know what the controversy really is over hacking back. I will say that it's not that corporations don't occasionally hack each other, but the way they usually do it is by hiring a high-level technical person in the opposing organization and then just asking them what that company had as terms of technology. So that's the traditional way. It has more to do with, humans than SIGINT, I would say.
So, I think we've come to the sort of end of the interview, and, we always like to have the guest give us, the last word, comment, etc. So, before we end the interview, give us a sort of last comment and something to leave the audience with.
Well, I think, one thing I find really awesome is that, frankly, you can learn a lot of the strategy and a lot of the stuff from a very enjoyable behavior, which is reading science fiction. And on the Immunity website, we actually have a bunch of books by Daniel Keyes Moran, who wrote them back in like 85. And they're just free PDFs you can download that talk a lot about hacking. And frankly, he's dead on about everything. I like to also follow Neil Stephenson's, all of his books. And of course, William Gibson's books have been, a favorite in the community. But frankly, I think if you haven't read all these books and you are a policymaker, then you're going to be at a disadvantage. We've had FBI directors and other things, or not FBI, DHS directors, like Jan Hall Lute, for example, who came out and basically said in their speeches, "I don't really understand cyber in any way." And I think that really put a pall on how the DHS was perceived in terms of how they were able to make decisions and sort of assure their customers that they're going to be the ones protecting them. You can't have the head of your community say, "We don't know what we're doing," and then say, "But we're taking it over, and we're gonna be there for you." And that's really why it's in this industry, it's really come down to the NSA, because no one in the NSA is going to say, "We don't know what we're doing in cyberspace." And I think that's why everything really does come back to the 800-pound gorilla, and it's not necessarily a bad thing to have people who understand stuff do stuff. That's realistically, that's my recommendation. I used to, we'd have proto-hackers come in, And they'd be like, well, how do I learn how to hack? And I'd say, well, just go to the first bug track and read all of them, this really famous mailing list from back in the day, until you get, you know, until you get to today. And when you reach today, you'll have an understanding of how things work. And then we can start talking to you about your, you know, the next step. And I think the same thing's true with policy making in the national security area using cyberspace. If you haven't at least read all the Daniel Keyes Moran books, starting with The Long Run, I mean, there's only two of them that really apply in this case, or, you know, the Neal Stephenson's Cryptonomicon book. I mean, if you're making policies on Bitcoin, but you haven't read Cryptonomicon, then I don't know what you think you're doing. It's just going to be funny. You're going to get outmatched the same way we're getting outmatched by WikiLeaks. And I'm sick of getting outmatched. It's kind of embarrassing. So that's kind of my overall thought on this stuff is you can, in fact, read up from the comfort of your beach hammock and become a better policymaker because of it. And it's free. That's awesome.
Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Sure. Well, thanks for having me.
Sure.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you. Okay.